Okay, well, today I have with me, do you want me to say your name?
Totus Anctus.
Totus Anctus. And Totus and I have been in touch for several years now, and we've communicated by email and by letter. And more recently, Totus contacted me and said that he'd written this booklet, or it's actually two booklets that he's combined into one, which he was kind of compelled to put together. And I think you'd done this in late 1990s and early 2000s, didn't you?
Yes.
And I think you finally published this in 2001, but you didn't put it onto general release or anything, did you? Or,
no.
So we'll talk about that a little bit. But the title of the booklet, or the two booklets, are Thought Police, Inside Our Heads and Controlling the Human Race. And then Nothing to Worry About, Probably Just a Coincidence. And you've put this dot notation here, haven't you, in between the words, so we'll probably get to explain that. So I've had a look through this booklet, and it's very interesting, and I was kind of... It's one of those things where, you know, you've been going through all this stuff for a number of years, and you see these themes emerging in what you're reading about, which is essentially, in a word, a type of control that you're being subjected to. And that's what we're going to talk about with Totus today. And he's agreed to go through the booklet with me. I will have some copies of this booklet that Totus has given me, and I'm probably going to put it into PDF form as well, as Totus has given me permission to do that. And so it should be downloadable if you want to look at it. Or if you wanted the physical version, the paper version, then you can get that from me by post. And just going into the inside of the booklet, I'll read out a couple of the quotes that Totus has put in here. Resolve to be thyself, and know that he who finds himself loses his misery, which is a quote by Matthew Arnold. And then this is another good one, the second one on the inside cover here. If you have a hero, look again. You have diminished yourself in some way. And that's from No Hidden Meanings by Sheldon Kopp. And that's something which I've also identified with in certain ways, in that I try not to have heroes anymore. Or it's, I don't feel I've ever really had particular heroes, maybe certain people that stand out. For example, I know people who hunt autographs. They go for autographs. I've never been big into getting people's autographs. I think I've got a couple, only one of which I asked for, and that was Richard Whiteley, for heaven's sake. So there you go. That was when I was 11 years old, by the way. That was 10 or 11. So what we're going to do is, Totus has kindly agreed to spend some time with me today, and we're recording this in April 2017, and just to put a time reference on that. And he's kindly agreed to go through the booklet with me, or some of it, and explain the reasoning behind it. So perhaps you'd like to just give me an introduction as to what kind of triggered you off into this idea of making something like this.
Well, thank you, Andrew. This booklet came about as a result of a few strands of information. And it keyed into a question I'd had since my early teens as to why we were always killing each other on this planet. And I could never understand it. Most of us weren't like this. Most of us wanted to get along with each other.
Right, right. And so we've had these themes of warfare and conflict, which... Well, maybe some people would disagree with me, but much of our society seems to be geared towards that. And if I may just inject something here, which I read a number of years ago, it seems that if you look back through human history in terms of the type of warfare, we started off with a kind of almost feudal conflicts, then it went to tribal conflicts, then it went to maybe regional conflicts, and then between countries, and then we ended up with a world war in the 1900s. And so we seem to have had this increase in scale of conflict. And so, you know, I think that, how does this happen? How do you mobilize large numbers of people to go into a large scale conflict? I think that's
probably the gist of this book. It's about programming. It's about making people believe things that aren't necessarily true, or even better, that they have a slither of truth in it, and others will not see that it is a slither, and there's other aspects that are present that undermine that slither of truth. One example I could say is in one of the questions that one of the seven questions that I've got, which we'll come to, and it's a simple saying, and it says it's practice makes
blank
blank, and it's a word that starts P-E-R and there's an ends with a T. And everybody out there who's got a brain worth a name, with a few exceptions, will tell are already saying that to themselves. Yeah. And I will show you that that isn't true when we come on to it.
Yeah, that's a great example. And so, yeah, so you start off with this. I think this forms the first half of the booklet, doesn't it, where you kind of come out with these questions and ask people to ask themselves these questions. And typically you have a kind of, as you're implying there, a default answer that people will come out with. And, you know, and then you sort of break that down as to why that has become the answer that most people would give, and what the problems are with that answer.
The answers they're giving are programmed answers.
Yes.
And what these questions are doing is trying to identify that programming and tell you that, unfortunately, for whatever reason, you're either inaccurate or you're wrong.
Yes.
And the subject matter of these questions, you really need to be as accurate as you can be, because they're being used against you and everybody else, so that we're all at each other's throats.
And that's where this idea of the thought police inside our heads, that's really what you're talking about with that, isn't it? So, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're really essentially illustrating here with what you've written and the way that you've put this together, that this thought policing, we do it ourselves because we've been programmed essentially to do that. And so we do it without even thinking about it.
Correct. And I've described it as authority figure talk, because we get it from our mums and dads, and mums and dads in their turn from grandparents and so on and so on. Occasionally these things adapt or change, or they're dropped because of changing circumstances. But the particular definition I've used here is deadening authority figure talk, because it stops you thinking in a balanced way, and that is D-A-F-T, or yes. DAFT.
I like how you've done that, some of this. You've used some of these acronyms. Things are repeated to us to stop us from thinking that what is being told to us in this repetitive form is actually wrong or inappropriate or not. Or it stops you thinking of alternatives.
And that is another way of answering the question three, which says practice makes.
Right.
And everybody's shouting out perfect, aren't you?
Yeah, but the correct answer really is...
I will tell you.
Mm.
Watch this space.
Yeah,
or
watch
listen
this space
to
indeed.
It.
So we'll go through that and we'll tell you what that is. So... you start off with question one, what are the reactions to stimulus of fear? And just to read a little bit at the top there, fight and flight and you think of a rabbit in the car headlights, and you freeze, and you have this expression, scared stiff. So let's talk about that for a little bit.
One of the things that is usually missed, it's a bit of a funny sort of question, I had to word it carefully, but usually what you get is fight and flight. They always say fight and flight. So you switch off and you're not thinking about something else which is what you do. And one of the quotes here is, "We, like other members of the animal kingdom, are designed to freeze when we feel there is imminent danger. A gazelle, for example, will stand stock still if it suspects a lioness is near." So there's another side to this. There's a freeze reflex. And a reflex is independent of the will. In other words, you'll do it anyway, regardless of what you think you will or you won't do. Of course, what happens to the rabbit? Well, generally it gets splatted if it stays there.
Yes, yeah, so this idea of being frozen by fear, by reflex action, when I was reading this part, it made me think of, you know, going back to our animal instincts, as some people call them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking, well, what makes us different to a rabbit? What, you know, in other words, yes, we do freeze in situations of fear. And as you say, scared stiff, you know, that's one of our common expressions. But there appear to be certain people that don't just have that reaction.
My point about the freeze side of it is that lots of the threats that we face are not like that with a lion or a physical threat where you have to physically get up and deal with it. It's in the mind. These are psychological and emotional threats where, for example, you won't be able to pay the mortgage if you don't comply with X, Y and Z. It's not a simple case of going up to the boss and throttling them or something. To say, hang on, this I'm not going to do this. It doesn't work like that. And
I suppose we could make an analogy to take the rabbit situation again. What about if we go up to a rabbit with two lights that are equally the same space as a car headlights, shine it on the rabbit, and the rabbit may experience exactly the same reaction as in a real car headlights, but it's not a real car. We've just got two lamps or two torches. And that I suppose is, you know, what you and I now know is that we're being put in a situation where we're told to be afraid or be worried about scarcity or something like that, and then we get the reflex reaction, whatever that might be, because we're put into a situation of a threat which might look real, but actually it's not.
No. Or it could actually be real on a few occasions, for example, where people are made examples of, so that the rest of the people will then comply. So this idea of controlling people is to keep them in a freeze level of reflex.
Yes.
So you don't come out into the open with a big stick or something that's obvious. You do it in a subtle way that doesn't provoke such a strong reaction or reflex, rather.
Absolutely. And I think sort of what you've got under that paragraph, the way you go through some of that, you have this quote and it says, "Understanding leads to release from the control of unconscious energies." And that's from What We May Be by Piero Ferrucci. And that again resonates with me because, as I've said on a few of these interviews and things that I've done, I'm a tutor for the Open University, so I regard it as my job in that role to help people understand things and thereby give them a bit more freedom in whatever they're doing. Admittedly, the stuff that I tutor on is, you know, technology, and you could make your own arguments about, you know, the strengths and the merits and demerits of understanding technology. But that's, to me, you know, that's where you've got to get to understand things, to free yourself from control.
Some of the examples that provoke in the freeze reflex are things like where you have scarce resources. For example, you haven't got much time, you're always busy, yeah, busy, the work pressure's on you. There's no time to think creatively, you just have to get on with it and do it. Other things include things like technology, which can help you, but very often they just speed things up.
Yeah.
And if you're already under pressure and things are going quicker, you're just even more busy, busy, busy. And yes. it's a covert form of training. And without knowing it, you're just complying. And part of the consequences of that is a quote that says, too often pressure squeezes out our native compassion. And what I'm sort of saying there is that you're tending to behave like an automaton, and the chances of you stepping back and expressing some kindness or compassion just doesn't get a look in. Now, yes. should maybe it does. There's always consequences for this. If you happen to understand things and you don't wish to comply, there's a whole list of consequences which I've quoted from another book. And I'll list them here. It starts with fear, which is the silent threat, or intimidation, that's the threat of a threat, harassment, the ongoing threat, shame, the open threat, ridicule, well, that devalues, doubt, that saps credibility, diversion, sows confusion, labelling, that closes the mind. Defamation and slander, that's the shotgun approach when everything else fails. So there's all sorts of psychological threats going on here, and it's very difficult for people to stand up on their own two feet and speak out.
But this takes you away from your sort of more, the your emotional centre. It moves you away from that, and it moves you away from, as you say, from compassion and those sorts of emotions, and they get suppressed, and you know, in themselves sometimes ridiculed, that you would dare to sort of show some type of humanity in a given situation. That can also be, you are discouraged from doing that in many situations. So yeah, absolutely, and that's a good list there of psychological tactics which are used to maintain the status quo as well.
Yes, it tends to degrade down into an expression that we have, which is called getting away with it, so that you don't have to take the hard route or the tough route that means you're going to get clobbered if you do stand up. You just take the easy route and comply.
Yes, yes. And of course, you and I, we were speaking about this earlier today, and that we've kind of broken out of the mould to some extent. And although we both have to earn a living, and you know, we have to pay certain bills so that we can have, you know, we don't grow cold in the winter and we don't die of starvation. Outside of that, we do try and point out that the system is rigged to keep us in the system. And when we go outside of it, life becomes, the more we go outside of it, the more difficult life becomes for us.
And that's because the system is designed to exploit our energy to the extent that it's sort of almost like a free energy device on its own. It sort of self-runs, and we feed it without realising.
Yes, yes. And you write a little bit on this page about us. I'll just read, I won't read all of this, but as small children, we react spontaneously from the heart, our truth. And we were talking earlier on about how I was listening to a talk by Frank Willis. And he'd pointed out in this talk, which had some very unusual stuff in it, but one thing he did point out, which really hit me, was how you often, if you write a letter to a young person, particularly a young man, who might be, you know, under the age of 16, they are addressed as Master, you know, Master Johnson or Master Smith, Master Andrew Johnson or whatever. And I remember getting this letter to Master Andrew Johnson Esquire. And Frank Willis pointed out in this talk that was because below the age of, say, what, you can choose an age, but say 16, 15, 14, 13, 12, you are master of your own mind. You are working from the point of view of a child, and you haven't been enslaved by the system intellectually or mentally. So that's why you're called Master, because you're master of your own mind. And you then at some point become a Mister. So when you change from being a Master to a Mister, that's when you've had your head filled enough with other people's thoughts and ideals that your ability to think for yourself has been sufficiently reduced and you've been made to conform to the way the system works.
Yes, and if all those ideas don't work, as I've mentioned, there's the list of consequences there. And much when we're younger, that comes into smacking and physical, well, violence, I suppose. I'm not talking about a simple clip round the ear. You know, you're getting whacked for things that just, you know, for playing, play fighting, for example. Yes. And it tends to undermine your capacity to think in a reasonable way. One example I can think of is play fighting with my brother, and we'd be summoned down to the kitchen by my mother, and it was quite a simple process of who started it. And I didn't know what was going on. I was new to this game, and my brother, before I could breathe, said he did. So I ended up being whacked, and that made me cry. It upset me. I didn't understand what was going on. This then progressed. We started up another play fight. Being a bit of a slow learner, I got clobbered again. And yet again, lies were being told. Mm. I knew it wasn't true. He's an older brother, and he knew the game because he's got a brother above him, so he knows what he's doing. It's not doing me particularly any good, so off we go again, two or three more times, and I'm trying to figure this out. What is it that he's doing? Whatever he's doing, I'm always getting it. I'm always being whacked. And I realised whether he told the truth or whether he lied, that didn't matter. What mattered was it was believable. And it was my mother that believed him. And this is about telling the most plausible, believable story. And my suggestion is that if that's going on, without offending the laws of logic, arguing from the particular to the general, because I don't think I am, because I think generations of us have had this, what would you expect to see in the adult world?
Yep.
Getting away with it. And I'm not talking about a shortcut to work or something, or to the shops. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about accepting responsibility for your behaviour.
Mm.
And you've seen over the last 20, 30 years, this being degraded down and down and down.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think there's another aspect that comes in there, in that because, you know, okay, so in that situation with you and your brother play fighting, you got the whack. I'm imagining that your brother didn't speak up and say, no, well, it really was me, you shouldn't have hit him. Did he say that or did he not say that?
Never.
And so my point is, I'm not trying to get at your brother or anything, but because of the way this system works, is that the person who actually did cause the trouble won't admit it because they're afraid of the consequences. In other words, they themselves don't take responsibility for them actually committing an injustice. And we're discouraged from doing that quite often.
Because they've had the same treatment as me previously.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the cycle continues.
Correct, because they've been belted. Mm. So, you know, they decide that it's easier to keep the mouth shut because they're not going to get belted.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah, and then you go on, I think, to extend that a little bit. Yeah, so you got later on, I think we're on page 4, would you administer a small or lethal amount of electricity? So perhaps you can give us some of the background to this what's on this page.
This is a book, or some experiments by Stanley Milgram, and he's an American professor, and he constructed a memory test, in essence, where a learner was punished by a teacher for incorrectly answering certain word pairs, and if they got them wrong, they got an electric shock. Those electric shocks went up in 15 volt increments from 0 to 450. And the vast majority of people will, of course, say, no, of course I wouldn't electrocute another human being, a stranger. But if you look at the Stanley Milgram experiment, I think it was in 1962, and it's on YouTube, I think you might be rather unpleasantly surprised, because the teacher was shown that that learner was strapped in, wired in, and he was even, the teacher themselves were given a sample shock to say that it was genuine. So there's no kidding, there's no pretense. There were multiple different tests, but essentially one of the biggest results of this was that 26 out of 40 volunteers electrocuted another human being for wrong answering of word pairs. All of the volunteers went up to 300 volts. As far as I understand it, 240 volts is enough to kill someone.
Yep.
There are 15 volt increments. I think that's about 6 increments. So all of us have gone up to 300 volts simply because they were asked to comply with the experimenter's requests to continue with the experiment.
Yeah, and I mean, you read this and you watch the thing. I have seen the things on YouTube, and it's pretty extraordinary. You can't, because there doesn't seem to be any particularly strong argument, like that the person who's giving the shock, they're not, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're not threatened with punishment or death or anything like that, are they?
No.
Which is, you know, it's not like if you don't flick this switch, we're going to kill your family or we're going to kill your mother or something. That none of that goes on. It's just purely, as you said there a minute ago, an authority figure is telling them what to do with this switch, isn't it? Or these dials or switches or both. So, and then I think what it's at the bottom of the next page, because if I remember reading this correctly, again, correct me if I'm wrong, that one of them is presented with the what are these they've done, and they say to him, well, what if you killed this person? Obviously, you know, they find out that this isn't the person hasn't really been shocked. I think at the end of it, it is a mock up, but it's made to look very real. But they're asked after the session, what if you'd killed this person? And they say something like, well, it wouldn't have mattered because that's what I was told to do.
Yeah, that was a Mr. Gino who said when he was asked by his wife, I'm not sure how long that marriage lasted after that, when she said, suppose the man was dead, and he said, so he's dead. I did my job.
Yes.
This is compliance to a task, and there doesn't seem to be any compassion or understanding or appreciation of the consequences of their actions.
That's a quote I was looking for, yeah, and I couldn't quite find it while I was trying to read through there. Yeah, I did my job. He's dead. And, you know, it's extraordinary to think that people can be done, you know, can be put to that. And in this experiment, how long did it last? What, a couple of days? One day? A morning? It wasn't particularly a lengthy session, was it?
No, I don't think so at all. It's just, you're flicking switches.
Yeah.
And it's a very short, you can see some of them flick the switches quicker.
Yeah.
As if they're trying not to do it. There are some examples, or one example, where some chap is just refusing to do it, which is a great example for everyone. One of the biggest problems with this is when you get somebody else to do your work for you, because then we find, I think in experiment 18, 37 out of 40 of us helped deliver a lethal shock of 450 volts when somebody else was doing it for us. And this is where we come to a quote from Stanley Milgram in his book Obedience to Authority, and it says, the essence of obedience consists in the fact that a person comes to view himself as the instrument for carrying out another person's wishes, and he no longer regards himself as responsible for his actions. Once this critical shift of viewpoint has occurred in the person, all the essential features of obedience follow. The adjustment of thoughts, the freedom to engage in cruel behaviour, and the types of justification experienced. There's one extra thing I'd like to add, is you can make it a lot easier to get their willing obedience. Mm-hmm. That's the thing you really want, because then you don't have to push so hard. And I will come on to that a little later.
Okay.
Because that's linked in with something called an ideological justification.
Yes. And, you know, you can begin to see from this the foundation of, you know, I think you mentioned it, I think, later on, I think, correct me if I'm wrong again, the how the Nazi Party became such a force in Germany in the 1930s. Obviously, you know, there are other factors going on there as well, but this sort of thing where you can manipulate people quite easily, and as you said right there, this thing of making somebody obedient, it's, you know, it's not that difficult. You'd think that it would be harder, or I would, but it's actually not that difficult.
And that's because of the programming we've had when we were children.
Yes. Yes.
And it's unconscious. We don't know it's there, and it's being played on.
Yes.
And if you don't do as you're told, you don't eat your greens or the horrible stuff on the plate, you don't get any pudding. It's that type of thing. There's no reward.
And, you know, I think it's tough, though, as well. I mean, I have children, and, okay, you know, you don't necessarily want them to automatically conform to any given thing. But when you're trying to give them some framework, some moral code, again, when you start to look at, explore all of this, you know, do we as parents, should we be doing anything to give our children some type of moral code, or, you know, some kind of teachings about what is right and what is wrong? Or is it true that we do have a human instinct which shows us what is right and wrong naturally, just from, you know, the sort of heart centres, the emotional centres of our souls or our brains, however you want to say that? And I mean, I don't know the answer to this, but it's one of those very complicated questions, in that are some people born with a strong sense of what is right and what is wrong and what is just and what is unjust, and are other people born with no sense of that? You know, I don't particularly have an answer to that question. Or is all of those things learned, you know, learned behaviour? You know, I don't know.
Well, I'm no expert on that, but if you are having trouble with your kids, you'd be wise to look at a book called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk by Adele Faber and Elaine Maslisch, which was published in about 1999. And there's some quite funny cartoons in there of behaviour of children acting up, if you like, or misbehaving, mm-hmm. and parents who are pulling their hair out, getting together and working out some sort of solutions that will help the parents' fuse box stay intact for a little longer. And it may also engage the children in a bit more constructive behaviour. As regards your question, whether some people have a higher moral code or more of a moral code than others, then my experience is, yes, they have. We have people like psychopaths and sociopaths and narcissists who don't seem to have any compassion at all. They don't seem to have any empathy. And you have other people at the other end who act from their heart. The heart does have empathy. The heart looks at the bigger picture, and it's very aware of consequences of certain actions, and it makes sure that, if it possibly can, everybody benefits, not just a select few.
And we're going to come on to some of that, aren't we?
You mentioned earlier about Nazi Germany. I've quoted here, during World War II, about 10 Gestapo officers in effect controlled 100,000 inhabitants of Würzburg, using fear to condition them to inform on those thought to be undesirable. These suspects disappeared and the grapevine went to work. 10 people cannot control 100,000 others without 100,000 others contributing,
yes,
and assisting.
So in other words, there is a strategy at work to basically get the people to reprogram themselves in accordance with the agenda of the small group of 10, you know, in this particular example. And I suppose that's what we're subject to on a much larger scale now.
And usually with much more dilute consequences, but yes, more often. There's something else about exposure, which I'll come on to in another question, rather than do it now. Perhaps this is an appropriate quote as well, which we've mentioned earlier about not physically beating somebody. This is from the Talmud, and it says, "You can kill a person once, but when you humiliate him, you kill him many times over."
Yes, and you talk about a mental or emotional death.
And in its place, instead of the heart, there's a brick wall that starts to be built, and it's there to defend what's left of your heart. Unfortunately, it tends to end up bricking off the heart, except with rare occasions or extreme circumstances when we're adults.
Yes, yes, and I mentioned earlier on in our conversation before the interview that I was kind of wondered if you'd heard of Wilhelm Reich, because that type of concept, you know, you described this idea of putting a kind of a brick wall around your heart, or, you know, and you've got this in your picture, which we'll talk a bit more about later on. And Wilhelm Reich talks about this emotional armour that people build up, which becomes, you know, when this emotional armour, you know, is formed in a certain way, it causes all kinds of psychological problems for people, you know, depression, and I think you've mentioned this somewhere. I remember coming across that in your writings here, and it can give you all kinds of mental health issues, and it's to do with this emotional armour. It's to do with this strangulation of the heart, and it's kind of the suppression of its function.
Well, yes, I mean you're talking about repression.
Mm.
You can suppress things temporarily because of whatever other circumstances you find yourself in, but if you don't get a chance to release or discharge that pent-up energy, that can cause problems at the energetic level, which will then feed through into the biochemical or, yes, physiological levels.
Yes, and just on a simple thing, you know, the idea of stress, particularly in people that live a sort of high-speed life, or they've got a very stressful job, and they could have a good diet and everything, but if they get too stressed, that's it. You know, their health can become rapidly much worse, and they become immunosuppressed and can get sick very easily, and all kinds of problems can develop from stress. So, you know, people actually know that as well. That's the joke of it. And yet these people still get stressed.
Well, they keep doing things that hurt themselves.
Yes.
And you're back to Stanley Milgram again.
Yeah.
They know it's wrong. There's a quote here from his book. It says, "Some subjects were totally convinced of the wrongness of what they were doing, but could not bring themselves to make an open break with authority."
Yeah.
What they failed to realise was that subjective feelings are largely irrelevant to the moral issue at hand, so long as they are not transformed into action.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this has all been written about, and, the people that are running the planet, they know all of this, and they built it into the system, and it's been in the system for years.
That makes it normal.
Mm.
And if it's normal, it's okay, and if it's okay, you're not going to question it.
Yeah.
Normal is just what everybody else does. Well, that doesn't mean it's correct, true, or whatever. It's just what everybody else does.
Yes, indeed. So that, I think that sort of brings us on to the answer to the question we talked about at the beginning, doesn't it? Does it, or do you think, you know, on the next page that I'm looking at now?
Well, yeah, this is linked into it, because we think this is the question practice makes, and it's one word. The answer is one word, and it begins with a P and ends with a T. And everybody shouts to themselves, perfect, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Unfortunately, it's not quite right or correct. How long ago did you hear that? I remember being about 10 or 12. I was old enough to understand the words. And my father said it like an automaton. And I didn't quite grasp. I thought something was wrong with it. I didn't know.
Intuitive, you didn't quite...
Just something didn't ring right. Yeah. It sounded right, but it didn't ring true.
Didn't sit properly with you, yeah.
So let's give you an example. If you try to catch a tennis ball with a hand shaped like crocodile jaws, you'll become better at timing the catch, but your success rate will still be low, particularly if you're under pressure or it is a hard ball. It will hit the heel of your hands and most likely bounce out before your hands can close around it. This type of practice can hurt you and emotionally get you down. However, if your hands are relaxed, shaped like a bowl, palms facing the ball, fingers spread and relaxed, experience tells us you have a far higher success rate in catching the ball, hard or soft, or under pressure. This type of practice puts you in the know and gives you confidence in your own ability. Many people, for example, play sport at a certain level all their lives, and practice does not raise their game. Granted, their main purpose is the social side of the game, but it just goes to show. And another example is that people drive cars for years and their driving standard is still poor. So what is it then? It's not practice makes perfect. We've got other sayings like old habits die hard. If you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always gotten.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what that's saying is that practice doesn't make perfect, although practice does make perfect. If you're just moving a pen from one part of a table to another part of a table, you'll eventually get that right. There's nothing to learn. But when there's something to learn and you need wisdom gained through awareness or experience, and you then feed that back in, what you're doing is making... you're actually putting in a feedback loop there, which will make things a lot better. But the trouble is, if that information or parts of that information is filtered out or you're kept ignorant, then your practice makes permanent.
Yep.
And that, if it's done cleverly and done well, it'll be somebody else's permanent.
Yes.
And you and me and Bloggs and Smith will not know until they get wise to other information that casts it into doubt. Let me give you an example. Yeah. If a baby, this is a quote from The Suppression of Knowledge by Michael Roll, a small booklet. He says, if a baby from birth is told by loving parents that 2 + 2 = 3, and later at Sunday school, kindergarten, preparatory, public school and university, this young mind is again told by clever and often highly respected teachers that 2 + 2 = 3. This, added to the same teaching from the mass media backed by the weight of law, is it any wonder that many people often in responsible positions believe that 2 + 2 = 3? And I'd like to add to that, we'll fiercely defend it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So repetition may be the mother of learning, but too often it is of indoctrination.
Yes.
And the part of this practice, we practice many things like finance, things like religion, things like, well, education, things like science, and things like orthodox medicine, which I will come to in the second part of the booklet. another aspect of practice makes permanent, or practicing something, another way of looking at that is to say that you're having there's an exposure to a certain experience. And so, for example, if I were to say to you, you were exposed to acid, say your hand or something, what are the sort of things you would want to know about? Mm. Well, you'd probably want to know about how strong the acid was, and for how long your hand was in there, and will I keep my fingers, doctor?
Mm.
So let's try another. Ultraviolet radiation from the sun. Most people are quite good at this, and they'll be recalling things like, well, I'd like to know the strength of the sun's rays, for example, you know, was it at midday?
Yep.
They'd like to know the length of time spent sunbathing. And one more thing that they wouldn't pick up, because it's been worked, the question was define exposure, for example, to acid. One thing they wouldn't pick up is the number of times you've sunbathed. They wouldn't pick up the number of times you're exposed to acid, because it's implied it was once.
Yes.
Now, what we're saying there with the ultraviolet, for example, is that your exposure is the product of the strength of the sun's rays, the time length you were in the sun, and the number of times you went out in the sun. Mm-hmm. Which boiled down is concentration times duration times frequency, or in clever talk, intensity times frequency. The point is that frequency may be missed or confused with duration.
Yes.
Now, another way of doing that is to say, rather than sort of punch you in the face, because that's obvious, it's a one clear strike.
Yes.
Rather than that, if I just gently press my finger on your arm, and it doesn't look like I'm doing much, and I just gently, and I keep on doing that frequently, relatively lightly, there won't be much difference. And then it'll start to ache, and then it'll kill you because of the cumulative effect. And it's this cumulative effect that goes unmissed because it goes under the radar screen. It's a bit like microwaves and the immune system, with Barry Trower.
Yes.
Was talking about that, where it's not strong enough to provoke an immune response. So it does its damage anyway, and you've got no idea it's doing it, because you need the immune response for that to happen. I've put together a table here of different examples of fear, which you can look at. But the idea, the point that's being made here, is that you can have high frequency, short time length, low strength issues that can be worse than a trauma.
Yes. Yeah.
And part, as much as anything, they're undetected.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Now, just as an example, breathing. The Russian physician, Professor Buteyko, came up with a theory that a majority of the human population actually overbreathes, some more severely than others. Because people are unaware of this factor, he called it hidden hyperventilation. And if you were to do a little bit of research, I think we're supposed to be breathing at rest something like 3 times a minute. Well, most of us would be turning blue if we tried that. So that's just an example for you, with regard to the stresses that we're under.
And I like this table, as you put it, because it does make you think about how you're exposed to things in a slightly different way than, you know, than you would think about. You know, in other words, the way that you've put it in this table makes it more obvious as to how some of these strategies that they're, you know, keeping you in a state of stress and fear, why they do that, why they cause that stress and fear, because of the overall effect, which is cumulative. And you've got another table on the next page, on page 8 as well, which is, you know, another kind of laying out of how these stresses actually can be impact on you.
Widespread anaesthesia increases the demand for excitation by noise, speed, violence, no matter how destructive.
Mm.
And if we're being sort of turned into sort of unconscious beings, it's not a good path to go down. That was a quote from Limits to Medicine by Ivan Illich.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you've got a lot of these quotes which are, you know, do go into the heart of some of these issues. And going back to the breathing, you've got to be human. It's not just to breathe. It is to control one's breathing.
Well, they can be more easily made to hyperventilate because of the stresses and the environment around them.
Yeah.
The point, part of the point is to be conscious. You can't control your breathing unless you're conscious of it.
Yes.
And that's key to this booklet, because it's trying to show you some of the unconscious things we accept as children and we just continue on as adults in different flavours or ways.
Yes, absolutely.
And we all end up getting at each other.
Yes.
Or just under the surface. It doesn't take much before we are.
And again, on the next page, on page 9, you have another quote at the top there, from The Successful Self by Dorothy Rowe. And I remember reading this, going through this. Babies do not come into the world believing that there is something wrong with them. They arrive pleased and curious and ready to complain when something is not to their liking. But soon it is made clear to them that their complaints are not acceptable. Babies find this unfair, and then it is made clear to them that they themselves are not acceptable. This is again one of the sort of things which you're battling with in early childhood and upbringing. You know, I've brought up children, and you know, it's a difficult thing to deal with in terms of how much do you impose your will for your own easy life and your own, you know, laziness, if you want to call it that, onto the child. Where do you draw that line, and how much are you affecting that child's development, and how much are you discouraging that child from, you know, being totally free in its reactions to what is around it. That gets eroded. Their free will gets eroded during their upbringing.
Well, I think there's an unconscious element in there that the idea that somebody has free will means they can do what the hell they like. And that's not what is meant by that. If you act from the heart isn't going to do what the hell it likes. It's going to behave in a way that's kind and compassionate. And it will tend to look after itself, not necessarily need a big stick to have it conform or comply. And children will come at the parent through the heart. And if the parent's got a big brick wall around that heart, well, you know, what's going to give then? Who gives first? The parent? Is the parent going to just give in, or is the parent going to impose a brick wall and throw a lot of bricks at a child? And it's not to say that they don't implement boundaries, but you know, it's the toughest job in the world.
I think then you also get onto how our society works, and I mean how, for example, certainly in the UK, you know, where we are. If you want to have a reasonable standard of living and you don't, you know, you haven't inherited a lot of money or anything like that, like for example, in my family, both parents have been working to earn a living, and so you have a choice: do you go onto the treadmill to earn a reasonable standard of living, or do you sort of have a lower standard of living and look after your child more? But then again, by the age of 4 or 5, it is expected that you will put your child into a state-run school. And so this idea of you, you know, just bringing your child up on a kind of heart-to-heart basis, if you will, that then has to change, because the child's upbringing and care is no longer being handled exclusively by the parent. You have this other thing getting involved, which for many will have be highly... Some will have a good experience, and for example, the child will go into a class where, as far as the school situation goes, the child will be loved and looked after. But in other school situations, it may be the opposite of that. The child can be mocked, ridiculed, and so forth, and not treated very well. But that's outside the parent's control. It's at the much more it's much more down to chance as to where the child, which particular school or environment the child ends up in. So, and then you're down to a very much smaller number of children that are homeschooled, so they still get the influence from the parent rather than from the state-run schools.
Well, this picture is a picture of a... It's three sections reading from the bottom up. It has a picture of a heart, which is... depicted as a true self, and there's all manner of creative qualities about it, but it also has a naivety about it. But there's things like vitality and uniqueness, creativity, sincerity, intuition, inspiration, and spontaneity. As we grow up, as you mentioned, with the school as well as mum and dad, we end up with little bricks being built round our hearts, and that's not necessarily bad. It's just there because we need it there to protect our hearts from other people who maybe aren't quite so pleasant. We usually starts with bad, mad and sad. When we're young, we identify something that's bad that we don't like. If it's something that we don't like and we think it's a bit odd, we call it mad. And just in case it's associated with somebody we know, and we can't call them mad because that might reflect on us not very well, we call it sad. It's a very clever little sidestep. You get all sorts of things like ought not and must and never and all these types of things which may have their place. The bricks really are authority figure talk, and most of that is deadening or daft. The gaps in the wall are expressions of true feelings. The mortar that holds the bricks together are fear and ignorance. And the brick wall itself is our false self, which we present to the world in order to survive or be accepted or loved or appreciated. As we become adults, we just have similar stuff, but it has longer words. The psychologists call them rationalising. Examples include relativising, say one thing's worse than another, or minimising, or trivialising, or intellectualising, or normalising, or idealising. There's also a big DIS game goes on, D-I-S, so... If you don't like something or you perceive it as threatening, you go into the discredit mode, or you disbelieve, or you disqualify, or you dismiss, or you distance yourself, or you disown it, or them, or you destroy. There are other things, clever things like expediency. For example, the ends justify the means. Well, actually, I think it might be that the means shape the ends. That might be a bit more accurate. There's sophistry, which is clever, faulty reasoning. For example, practice makes perfect.
Yeah.
You've got deceptions, like praise your child and he or she will get a big head. You get manipulations, now be a good boy or girl and do as daddy or mummy says. And you get contradictions, like strict but fair and loving smacks. I never remember smacks in my experience being loving.
And cruel to be kind, that's another one of those phrases, isn't it?
It is. So there's a list of things that I've mentioned carried out. And that's just a sort of a very potted example of what happens, thumbnail sketch if you like, as to what happens when we grow up and are programmed.
Yes.
Now, just to get the behaviour to the desired way, there's a question here that says there's no surer way to make someone behave like a, for example, a moron, and that is to blank like a moron. What I'm trying to say there is that you have to treat them like a victim or a victimizer to get them to behave like one.
Yes.
And that sort of induction, I've drawn a parallel between one electrified wire is brought close enough to an unelectrified wire, and the second wire will conduct electricity too.
Well, when you mean when I was a kid, we used to have this. One of the things we used to say in our family is, you know, like my brother would say to me, "Oh, you're an idiot," you know, or they'd say it to one of the others, and then somebody else would simply pipe up, "Takes one to know one," you know. And that's kind of, I think, a reflection of your phrase there. And I think it was said as a kind of a defensive, kind of jokey type of witticism. But it's actually, I think, that there's a lot of truth in that. You know, it does take one to know. And it does, if you do treat somebody like something, they will become that thing, you know, become that type of person.
Well, that's what the truth is doing there. It's exposing the shortcoming of such a remark. So yeah. if you keep treating or reinforcing them like a slave to subordinate their free will and creative thinking, then they're not going to have much choice but to end up behaving like a slave or a slave driver.
And I mean, just to dwell on that idea of you know, the thing that's coming to my mind, which harkens back to an earlier point rather than this one just made, but I distinctly remember going from primary school to secondary school, you know, here in the UK where I went to school. And I used to love writing stories when I was, when I was 11 years old, I wrote this story and it's like 20 pages of A4. You know, it's a story about a picture where I see all these things in the picture and I get sucked into the picture and travel through these different worlds and stuff. And I wrote that when I've still got it in the loft actually, and I wrote this when I was 10 years old and or 11 years old. And then I used to love doing this. I did this probably from about the age of 8. I used to love writing stories. But then when I got to secondary school, there was almost no opportunity to do that anymore. We had to do the work for the curriculum, and we had one or two English essays that we had to do, one of which I was allowed to do a story that I'd made up. And that was the only chance I got to express that in that age. And, you know, it just that creative, there was no place for that creative work at that time, you know. So that's another example of how this sort of creative sort of process gets suppressed.
Yeah, that's mentioned in the education section. That's
right.
One of the examples that we practice, or is actually programmed into us, what you've just said there. And I will come on to there are 8 levels of intelligence, but 7 main ones, and you'll see it doesn't really matter whether there's 50 of them, because you're only going to get the left brain hemisphere that's going to get worked over, which is robot. So you've got you're reinforcing them, you're programming them, you're treating them like however you want them to behave. Now we're going to look at numbers now. How do you go about having a small group or a club or something of people? What about on the bigger scale then? Abraham Lincoln said, "It is true, you may fool some of the people all of the time, and even fool all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time." Well, I beg to differ. We know about the 100th monkey syndrome. When a critical number of monkeys are trained in how to complete a task, other monkeys totally unfamiliar with the task were found able to complete that task. So I would suggest then that in order to get or to take that into account, the expression would be more accurate to say, it is true you may fall some of the people all of the time, and even fall all of the people some of the time. But in order to fall all of the people all of the time, you only need to fall enough of the people enough of the time.
Yes.
That is, your exposure equals enough concentration or strength, or enough length of time, or enough numbers of times, frequencies, if you like, or any combination of these that is enough. Now, if you're living and surviving in a pyramidal structured society, enough doesn't have to be very much, because everybody's pressurising everybody else.
Exactly.
And they then call it normal.
Yes.
Which is even worse, because you label it, so it closes your mind and it's difficult to unpick it. Mahatma Gandhi said, the only devils we have to fight are the ones inside our own hearts, or in the diagram that's been drawn, the ones around our hearts that stop in our heart express itself.
Mm.
And I don't mean some soppy, sentimental rubbish that many people may be thinking of. I mean to stand up and do the right thing. To have the courage to do so. And remember that when you're provoking all this stuff, you're creating war. And when war comes, as Hiram Johnson said, the first casualty is truth.
Yes, this is a phrase that's often, you know, put out on a lot of these websites and podcasts and things. And, yeah, I think that is, it's an appropriate quote. But people outside of our, you know, line of thinking think of war in the literal sense of dropping bombs and invading countries and this sort of thing. They don't think of other types of war that are going on, psychological warfare that is waged upon us daily with a lack of truth, frankly. Through fear of death, you've got written there, war can encourage populations to think in ways they would otherwise not do, and accept the formation of the institutions that they would normally reject. The longer a nation involves itself in wars, the more entrenched those institutions and ways of thinking will become. And that's from William Bramley in The Gods of Eden, his book there. I've not read that book, actually, but I am familiar with the title, at least. And that, again, is a good quote. That's what it's very apt. It's what happens.
Well, how long have people been on this planet?
Yeah.
And what have we been doing?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think that is, an accident? Whatever happened to, but jaw, talk through your differences. But, of course, there's other entities, soulless entities, that don't want that. They want...
Yeah. Yeah.
Deeply imbalanced energy fields that they can feed off.
So I think what we're building up to a little bit here is, you know, is where is, in other words, why are we being programmed? Is there something going on which is doing the programming? I think we're starting to ask that question now, aren't we? Correct me if I'm wrong.
I would have said so, yes. If you've gone on that long with pestilence and disease and poverty and war, and the vast majority of us are not like that and abhor that, well, why hasn't it
waned?
Why hasn't
it died out?
Why
hasn't
it died down or died out or is on the way out?
Yeah.
Why are we invading everybody left, right and centre?
Yeah, and I mean, we've just seen, you know, a lot of people, just to digress very slightly for a minute, people have talked about 2012 being this great awakening and change in consciousness and stuff. And a few years before that, I was really quite hopeful that would happen. But of course, here we are in 2017, and they've just now launched these attacks in Syria again. And we've seen a repeat of all these various alleged terror incidents and all that nonsense again. So it just seems like nothing has changed in the last 15 years to my way of looking at things. And I suppose that sort of ties in a little bit with your next heading on page 15 here, where you've got thought creates reality and so does belief. And maybe this whole thing about programming is creating a mindset which then stimulates certain thought patterns and perpetuates them. Practice makes permanent, and that's what starts to create reality, perhaps. I think that, I'm guessing that's the sort of thing you're leading into here.
Yes, it's summed up simply by, I think it was Dr. Samuel Johnson who said, the chains of habit are too weak to be felt until they are too strong to be broken. And that's the programming, the belief systems, where continually we seem to be asked to look out and look up for guidance and for wisdom and for knowledge, when in fact it might be better if we did our own research and questioned everything.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Maybe that's absolutely. That's just too hard to do with all this convenience that we're being sold.
And again, that's another we're going to get on later, to the how this whole idea of looking into yourself to find things out and, you know, come across certain answers is kind of discouraged. The programming itself discourages looking in that direction and tends to encourage you to look outwards and look to these other people who supposedly know all of this stuff and, you know, wanna ram it down your throats, basically, in one way or another.
Well, homeschooling of children, what's the big problem?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is just a summary of the seven questions and their answers.
Okay.
Which is in the second column. It's three columns and seven rows. And we've been discussing those seven questions, and there's a simple answer to each of them. And in the third and final column, there's a description as you pull across from each question, but you read it vertically, of how a minority enough acts with impunity over a majority, that's you and me. And this is how it's suggested it's done. The human freeze reflex to fear bypasses the will. You incorporate this with exploitation of obedience to authority within various hierarchies. For example, finance, religion, education, science, and orthodox medicine. You, with examples of the above, but these atrocities are visible, so war and things like that, killing, and they create opposition or defiance after the event, i.e. they're challenged. Well, you don't want challenge coming out, because you're going to end up in trouble, you're creating attention. So what you're looking to do is practice this reflex so it becomes permanent, but you do it covertly.
Yep.
You lower the strength and the time length, but increase the frequency to have a similar effect, also making it less detectable, i.e. it's covert.
Yep.
You maintain the permanence by induction, i.e. keep treating them like slaves or victims, inducing us into being normal, because everybody else does it, so they're not going to pick it, because there's nothing different there that they can compare it with. And remember, you only have to do it enough times to enough people, or enough of the time, or any combination of these that is enough to in effect have control of the whole. Just in case, after all of this, creativity and inspiration see through the accepted order, con people, impose belief, and the root of that word is replacing, impose belief systems for our own thinking. Con the cleverer ones into thinking it is, for example, ethics for religion or cash for loans and interest. The less clever will follow. Maintain this using consequences that I listed previously, or fear, fill in any spaces left in their minds with distractions to focus attention on their five senses preventing practical use of their intuition and imagination. So you get all the dross of the media and the fashions and all this stuff that fill every last pixel of our minds almost. And yep. it's very bewitching.
Yeah, and you know, things like the competitive sports, you know, mass followed sports, like in the US we have the American football and football in Britain, and all these sports that are just a big distraction to thinking about the deeper issues of the heart and the intellect.